From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowain with Fresh Air. Last week, British hostage John McCarthy and this week, American hostage Edward Austin Tracy were freed by the Islamic Jihad, and there's hope that other hostages will be released as well. Coming up on today's Fresh Air, a talk about surviving captivity with former hostage David Jacobson. In 1985, he was kidnapped in Beirut and freed 17 months later. Also, the struggles of a Hollywood screenwriter with screenwriter-turned-novelist Bruce Wagner. And book critic John Leonard reviews Topless, the new thriller by D. Keith Mano, about a young priest who gets mixed up in a topless bar and murder. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. If the United States is in the midst of intense diplomacy to gain the release of Western hostages, the State Department gave no indication of it today. The Bush administration appears to be pinning its hopes on negotiations by UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar. Barry Schwide has more.
Reports of secret U.S. contacts with Shiite extremists in Paris are being dismissed. The State Department is again ruling out concessions or deals with kidnappers, and Israel is not being told to release Sheikh Obeid or any other prisoners, although spokesman Richard Boucher said the U.S. would like to see all hostages released. Because the best chance for freeing the Americans apparently lies with Perez de Cuellar and one grand exchange, the Bush administration is emphasizing that anyone held outside the legal system should be freed. And that points to the 375 or so prisoners held by Israel and its Lebanese allies. At the same time, though, there is appreciation for Israel's demand that its own prisoners be set free or accounted for. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
An official at the U.S. Hostage Reception Center in Wiesbaden, Germany, said that former hostage Edward Tracy will return to the United States tomorrow. Navy Commander John Woodhouse said that Tracy will probably require psychiatric counseling after almost 5 years of captivity in Lebanon. Tracy will be accompanied to the United States by medical personnel and a State Department team. He's to be taken to a veterans facility in Boston that specializes in treating post-traumatic stress disorder. After his release, officials said Tracy appeared disoriented, stumbled, and had trouble completing sentences. A federal judge in Wichita, Kansas, sent another anti-abortion protester to jail today. Gordon Basham of member station KMUW filed this report.
Federal Judge Patrick Kelly told J. Cody Gibson his actions were disgusting and a blatant defiance of his court order, which prohibits the blocking of the entrances to two local women's health care clinics. Gibson was accused of directing children to lay down in front of cars carrying patients into the clinic where abortions are performed. Judge Kelly told Gibson, a chimney sweep from Neosho, Missouri, he might grant him an early release if he promised to sever all ties with Operation Rescue. Meanwhile, about 100 followers of the movement showed up outside a women's health care clinic this morning, but no arrests were made. Operation Rescue's national leadership earlier had promised it might turn over the demonstrations to local protest officials after an August 25th rally, but now says it may extend its stay in Wichita indefinitely. For National Public Radio, I'm Gordon Basham in Wichita.
Stock prices gained slightly today on Wall Street, pushed up by news of a gain in retail sales in July. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 7 points to close at 3,008.72. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Exchange was 212 million shares. This is NPR. There was new fighting reported today in the Yugoslav Republic of Croatia as Croatians and ethnic Serbs exchanged gun and mortar fire from their positions in two neighboring villages. Croatian radio said that Yugoslav Federal Army units also contributed to the shooting. The latest fighting came as the 8-member federal presidency met to try to consolidate the ceasefire that it declared almost a week ago. In Peru, a former official accused of taking bribes from the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI, didn't show up Monday for his scheduled appearance before an investigative committee of the Peruvian Senate. Now, the senators are threatening to extradite him if he's not back in 72 hours. Mike DeMont reports from Lima.
The man who didn't keep his appointment is Leonel Figueroa, former president of Peru's Central Reserve Bank. Figueroa and the Reserve Bank's ex-manager, Hector Neda, are accused of taking $3 million in bribes from the BCCI. Both men say they are innocent. The bribes were allegedly paid so the Reserve Bank would place up to $270 million of Peru's money in the BCCI. All the funds were safely withdrawn and even earned interest. Figueroa says he couldn't keep his Monday appointment with the Senate because of work commitments. He has a job with the UN Latin American Economic Commission in Santiago, Chile. Now the Senate committee president has given Figueroa an ultimatum. If he's not in the Senate hearing room by 11 o'clock Thursday morning, he will take steps to have him extradited. I'm Mike DeMott in Lima.
A Polish-Israeli businessman has denied bribing Polish banking officials, but he acknowledged making millions of dollars by taking advantage of flaws in the country's banking system. Bogusław Bogsik is now in Israel and said he had no intention of returning to Poland, where seven banking officials had been arrested on charges of mismanagement of state funds. Bogsik said in a magazine interview that he made his money by rapidly transferring funds among about 100 bank accounts. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. On November 30, 1984, David Jacobson arrived in Beirut to head up the medical center at the American University. On May 28, 1985, he was kidnapped and held hostage for 17 months. Jacobson has written a book about his ordeal called Hostage, My Nightmare in Beirut. Jacobson writes that he and the other hostages lived in a basement prison, stripped to their shorts, blindfolded, and limited to a diet of poorly cooked subsistence fare, requiring permission to attend to the most basic personal needs, and under the threat of imminent execution for reasons beyond their control. On November 2, 1986, Jacobson was released. He learned later that he'd been part of an arms-for-hostages deal arranged by Oliver North, which would later come to light during the Iran-Contra investigation. When David Jacobson decided to move to Beirut, he had no idea what was in store for him.
I took a trip over in July of 1984 to see with my own eyes and to confirm what I had heard. Apparently the war was over, peace was at hand, all the parties were talking. I didn't hear any signs of war. When I arrived at the airport, they made certain that in the drive to the university, I didn't see any of the major signs of war. I had assurances from the Shiite militia and from the Druze militia and from the Christians that if I didn't get involved in any local politics, I'd be safe. I was doing humanitarian work, being the administrator of the hospital, and they wanted me. Apparently, the university had checked with the State Department. State Department had encouraged the employment of an American administrator because of the significant support of the university by the Agency for International Development.
You describe a shootout in the lobby of the hospital where you were the administrator. You were nearly caught in the crossfire. When did things begin to heat up again?
Well, that shootout was actually, nobody ever really thought of that as being a fight between the major militias. That was a little struggle between two small groups of Shiites, maybe a half a dozen men in each group, and they met in our lobby. They had an argument. They started to shoot.
Did that seem unusual?
Yes, it did. It was the probably the worst violation of the university and the medical center in the whole 10-year civil war. People were shocked because the American University of Beirut Medical Center was an island of safety, island of security. We took no sides in the struggle. We provided care and education for all people, regardless of their religious affiliation. It was an island of safety, and for a shootout to occur in our lobby, irregardless of the fact that it was just a small number of men, was a horrible crime. In fact, the Lebanese army was called out, and they assigned a company to provide protection for the medical center because they, too, were concerned for what had happened.
Well, did that make you feel that perhaps Beirut was a more dangerous place than you had come to believe?
Well, you know, you get war-wise very quickly. The war was still many, many miles away, and this happened to be just a gang fight. These things happen in New York City and in Philadelphia, and you don't hear the people saying, I got to get out of town. You know, there are more people that are murdered in the streets of Washington, D.C., or L.A., or Detroit, or Miami, than in West Beirut. So, when you're over there, you don't hear of what's happened. I tell people it was like being in the eye of the storm. The major storm had gone through, and things were relatively quiet. People did not talk about the war. They were all hopeful and optimistic that peace would be at hand. What we did know was that the backside of the storm was going to come and hit us. We should have known, but we didn't.
There were Westerners that were captured, I believe, while you were still working in Beirut. Did that make you any more nervous? Or did you think that boy, I might be next?
No, I never thought I'd be next. I never thought I was going to be kidnapped. When there were three Americans that were taken, but I really don't recall Ben Weir's kidnapping, any publicity about that. The only kidnapping that I was really aware of was of Terry Anderson, and that was a brief report there and on local radio and on the newspaper. One day, it quickly was no longer the lead item. People did not talk about it. There was feeling that he was kidnapped off of a public tennis court and that he shouldn't have been out there, and that which wasn't the case. There was misinformation given, but people just didn't talk about it. Because they had lived with, you know, this problem for years and years and years.
How were you captured?
I was walking from the campus where I resided to the medical center where I worked. And it was the only public exposure was at the intersection, a small intersection, about three car widths. There where Daniel Bliss and JFK Boulevard come together. I was walking with the chief of OBGYN, and there were couple hundred people in the intersection. It was jammed with cars, students walking into the campus, students walking into that entrance for the medical center. There were armed policemen at the gates to the campus, and there was one armed Lebanese soldier about 10 yards from me. A van pulled up. A gunman came running first and he cut us off and started to fight with the doctor. The doctor turned his back into him and was pushing him away. Two gunmen grabbed me from the back and were trying to force me into a van. I kicked at them. I hit them with my elbows. I tried to get away. Finally, in a brief period of time, may have been 1, 2, 3 minutes, the gunman fighting with the doctor took his pistol and fired two rounds into the pavement, then put the gun at the doctor's head, indicating he was going to kill the doctor if I continued to resist. At that point, I said, okay, I'll go, and I got in the van, which I was pistol-whipped at that point, bound, gagged, blindfolded, stripped of my valuables, my belt, my tie, my shoes, my wallet, and I was put in a compartment under the floor of the van and taken to the first place of interrogation.
I'm speaking with David Jacobson. He was director of the American University of Beirut's Medical Center. This was in 1984 and 1985. He was taken hostage in Beirut in the spring of 1985, and we're talking about his captivity and the conditions under which he lived. And he was held hostage for 17 months. Did you feel you had any control over your environment? Now, you write about the fact that they certainly controlled your bathroom behavior, the most kind of basic kind of behavior. Were there other parts of your life where you were able to kind of wrestle some semblance of control over?
Well, we actually, they denied us every freedom except the freedom to think and the freedom to pray. When we have those two freedoms, there are many, many coping mechanisms that you can use. I say that hostages survive because there are about seven coping mechanisms that anyone can use to overcome adversity or a crisis. And the first was that we were all religious men before we were kidnapped, and so a strong belief in God is a source of strength in this type of problem. We also had great beliefs in our own innate strength. We knew that we were educated, we were experience in living in the Middle East. We had some understanding of the Arab culture and the world of Islam. We also had the ability to think about our loved ones, which gave us some source of comfort and strength and a purpose to survive. Every one of us, and I would think Terry Anderson today and Tom Sutherland, who have been held almost the same length of time, an excruciating 6.5 years, none of us ever, ever really thought that our adversity would never end favorably. We always had faith that good things were going to happen. And there's an acronym, EGBOC. Everything's going to be okay. And that kept us going. We also maintained the ability to focus and become task-oriented and use our calculating powers. And we learned how to express our anger via appropriate self-assertion. We never pushed the guards too far. I used a lot of sarcasm with the guards, with a big smile on my face. Ben Weir got out, and he told my family he used to shudder when the things I would say at the guards, with a big smile on my face. I was used sarcasm you can't believe, but I expressed my anger that way.
One of the other things that you did was to carry on many political fights with Terry Anderson, who I guess you could consider your political opposite.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that made us survive, because what we were doing there was we were intellectually keeping alive, and Terry is very bright. I used to kid him. He was bright but not brilliant, but he's very brilliant and very bright man. But we could take any side of any arguments. We were sophists, and we would argue about things that were ridiculous. We weren't arguing against one another. We weren't adverse. We were keeping our minds alert. We could express our frustration in our argument and do things and say things that we couldn't say to our captors. And that was one of the coping mechanisms.
Would you almost say it's a kind of ritual argument that you were having in terms of how you can create the passage of time through rituals?
Oh, absolutely. And I know I was told, heard that one of the released hostages, I think it may have been Brian Keenan, that Terry was pacing around the cell looking for somebody to argue with. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I have deep admiration for Terry, and I think the fact that we could disagree on things was a source of strength for both of us and source of survival. In fact, I kid that I'm never going to go to hell because I've already been there. I was chained for 17 months with a journalist who was a liberal Democrat from upstate New York who believed the public had a right to know anything and everything. And I'm a moderate Republican with a social conscience from Orange County, California, hospital administrator who believes passionately in the rights of confidentiality and privacy. And if that was hell for me, can you imagine what it was for poor Terry?
Well, you could keep that conversation going for many, many months. Did you have plans for escape at all? Did you entertain realistic plans? And were there moments in time where you might have been able to escape?
Every day of my life as a hostage, I thought about escape. I tried to prepare myself continually for that. I did 600 push-ups a day in sets of 60. I did a minimum of 600 sit-ups a day in sets varying from 100 to 150 or whatever. Whenever I became very angry with my kidnappers, I would, just like an old basic training, I'd say, "Get down, Dave, and give me 50 or give me 100. I knew I wasn't getting meat protein to build my muscles. I was doing the very best I could to keep my upper body in condition. In the event that I ever had an opportunity, I would only have one. I'd have to make advantage of it. In fact, I practice garroting so that in the event I ever had a chance to stop a guard, I'd have to do it fast and without his making noise. I never had the real close opportunity. Oh, I had one opportunity to do that, but I was in no condition to pull it off because of all the olive oil I had been fed, and it was working on my stomach.
Well, you spent a fair amount of time trying to just get to the bathroom, right?
Oh, yes.
What news of the world leaked in?
Well, you know, it's amazing when you're kept like blind rabbits in a box how you can hear what's going on. Once one of the leaders of the Hezbollah came to see us, I guess to verify we're still alive, and we talked to him about, you know, you can feed us and you'll keep our bodies alive. If you don't give us something for our minds, our intellectual spirit will wither and die, and that's a worse death than a physical death. And so they let us have a little radio, a shortwave radio, a Sony 7-bander. Not full-time, but for an hour or so, maybe twice a day, and then the French hostages would get it. And then the guards, who were not supposed to listen to rock and roll music, they were supposed to be religious fundamentalist Shiites, they would listen to their rock and roll. We would get some outside news. We would hear Voice of America. We would hear BBC.
What effect did press reports in this country have on your captivity? Was there evidence, for instance, that people that were holding you were reading American newspapers or watching American television or listening to American radio?
Hezbollah listens and watches to everything that goes on into this country. Anything that is said in this country on radio, on television, or in the print media, they see very, very quickly. In my book, I describe an incident that happened to me in which at the time of Father Jenkel's release, I made a videotape. I ad-libbed. I stated that I gave my condolences to Bill Buckley, to the widow Bill Buckley and his daughters, mm-hmm. because I thought he had been married and had daughters. And the truth is, he had been married and he did have daughters. But the media told everybody that I had sent out a coded message.
They were reading your body language, I assume.
Right. And the media said that I had sent out a coded message because I had given my condolences to a widow and the daughter. A videotape was made of that message in this country, and it was sent to Lebanon. My captors showed it to me, and I was beaten very badly because of that. When I came home, you'll probably remember in the Rose Garden, I said to the media, in the name of God, back off. What you probably forget is that an irresponsible question was asked by a member of the White House press corps, and it so angered me that I pushed the president gently to one side, and I said, irresponsible speculation almost resulted in my death. Irresponsible speculation now could result in harm or death to the remaining hostages. I don't want that on my conscience. You should not have that on your conscience. And in the name of God, back off. Because it's one world. And there's a difference on how we perceive the media. Here we doubt. We have questioned what we see, what we hear. Over there, the media is viewed with absolute integrity. If it's on television, it's got to be true.
I'm speaking with David Jacobson. He was director of the American University of Beirut's Medical Center from 1984 until spring of 1985, when he was taken captive and held hostage for 17 months. He was held with Terry Anderson and Thomas Sutherland, who now mark their 6.5 years in captivity. Jacobson was released along with an American priest named Lawrence Jenko. He's written about his book. He's written about his years in Beirut and his thoughts on the American policy towards hostages. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. David Jacobson is my guest. He's written a book about his 17 months in captivity as a hostage in Beirut. The book is called Hostage, My Nightmare in Beirut. How were you actually released?
I was released for arms, as Reverend Ben Weir and Father Martin Jenkel were. There was probably 1,000 TOW missiles that were sold to Iran for my release. And it became a part of the Iran-Contra scandal. And the Soviet Union knew of the arms for hostages. They wanted to protect their Sandinista allies in Nicaragua. They knew that funds or armaments were being supported provided the Contras. So the Soviet KGB leaked to the Syrians the arms for hostage deal, knowing full well what would happen in this country, the mass frenzy over this, and they did their best to support their, you know, their Sandinista allies.
When were you aware, then, of the details for your release?
Not until everything broke the month after I got out. In fact, I am a very fortunate man because the story about arms for hostages was released the day after my freedom. The Syrians tried to release it basically the day before. If that had happened, I think Hezbollah would have been spooked and I would still be there in my sixth year of captivity with Terry and Tom.
Do you think that your freedom was worth, and I think it's true, the subversion of U.S. foreign policy, and this was carried out by Oliver North and others, unbeknownst to George Shultz and others who were the architects, in part, of U.S. foreign policy?
I really am not certain as to that Ollie did this on his own. I'm personally quite convinced that Oliver North is a good patriotic Marine colonel who follows orders, and that he was following orders, that people in the highest places in this country, including George Shultz, were fully aware of what was going on. the moral indignation over arms for hostages has always been a real surprise to me, because it is not illegal to provide arms or exchange for hostages. It's gone on for many, many times. In fact, about 200 years ago, we gave a completely equipped 36-gun frigate to release 115 American hostages held by the Barbary pirates.
But the U.S. government had banned sales of arms to Iran in 1979 after Iranians had seized the U.S. embassy in Iran. There was the Export Administration Act of 1979. The Reagan administration had added Iran to the list of terroristic countries in 1984. This was stated public foreign policy.
It is not unusual for our government to say one thing and act differently in private. I that's not unique to Reagan. That's probably gone on in every administration. I think if people want to become indignant over this, over arms for hostages, which is really a little drop in the ocean of arms sales, they should recognize that our wonderful country, and I don't mean that sarcastically, I love America. We are the number one arms dealer in the world. We provide more arms to the third world than any other nation. You don't hear any indignation by liberals or philosophers over that issue. And my kidnappers used to ask me, why do you bomb our children? Implying, why do you sell bombs to people who drop them on our innocent kids? I never had an answer for them.
Do you wrestle with, I mean, I realize that you didn't create the policy that created your freedom, but do you live comfortably with that? That's not a problem for you?
No, it's not. And I guess I can say that if you were held for as long as we were held under the conditions we were held, very frankly, you wouldn't care how you get out, except certain things you wouldn't do. You would never substitute your family in your place. Arms have been sold for hundreds of years. We still sell, you know, as I said before, this is a drop in the bucket. I think the real moral issue is, where do the Western democracies go? What role should they have? I think that is a more critical issue.
To what do you attribute the fact that there have been two more hostages released in the last week or so? Britisher John McCarthy, Edward Austin Tracy, who's an American. Why do you think they're being released, and what does that say about what's happening geopolitically in the Middle East?
Well, I think Iran finally wants to end the controversy. I don't think Iran really wants to have good relationships with the United States, but they need to have some type of rapport, economic rapport, with the European community. And so this was a way of starting that process. Everybody that comes out of the Middle East, out of Lebanon, it does so only on the orders of Iran. Not Hezbollah, it's Iran. They're the great Satan of this whole thing.
Do you think the people that held you should be prosecuted?
Absolutely, Marty. I have dedicated my life to their apprehension. I will do everything I can to help our government, and I have been helping to identify them, to locate them. I'm looking forward to the day when they are caught, when they are put on trial, they are found guilty. And I hope to be there the day they are punished.
My guest has been David Jacobson. He's written about the 17 months that he was held hostage in Beirut in his new book, Hostage. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. For as long as there's been a Hollywood, there's been a disillusioned and misunderstood screenwriter. F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote bitterly about it in his short stories. Now screenwriter turned novelist Bruce Wagner has written a black comedy about a struggling screenwriter, actor, and sometimes chauffeur named Bud Wiggins in his new novel, Force Majeure. Coming up, a talk about Hollywood with Bruce Wagner. That and more coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. There was growing optimism today that all Western hostages held in Lebanon may soon be free. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from London.
UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar said today that a hostage deal may soon be possible. Speaking in Geneva, Perez de Cuellar said he expects to meet with an Israeli delegation tomorrow to discuss the terms of a possible swap of Israeli servicemen held in Lebanon for Arab prisoners held by Israel. Any such deal would include freedom for the Western hostages held by Islamic fundamentalists. Perez de Cuellar said today that he believes the two sides are close to an agreement.
They are apart, but not that far. It is not a kind of an ocean. I would say that it is a river.
Perez de Cuellar said that the seven missing Israelis were now his biggest concern. If I could solve this problem, he said, almost everything would be solved. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
President Bush says that he's been told by UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar that there is perhaps a little bit more reason to be hopeful about the possible release of Western hostages held in Lebanon. Mr. Bush said that he told the UN Secretary General that he has his full support, including any talks on possible exchanges. While Mr. Bush repeated a U.S. policy forbidding talks with hostage takers, he said that the U.N. Secretary General was free to do whatever he wants to. An Iranian diplomat says that the Bonn government should consider pardons for the Hamadi brothers to help ease the release of Western hostages held in Lebanon. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
In a television interview, the Iranian ambassador to Germany said two German hostages in Lebanon are in the hands of the Hamadi clan. The ambassador said the family would free the hostages in exchange for the release by Bonn of the two Hamadi brothers. Mohammed Hamadi is serving a life sentence for hijacking a TWA jet in 1985 and murdering a U.S. serviceman on the flight. Abbas Hamadi has a 13-year sentence for helping kidnap a German businessman in Lebanon. Abbas's recent request for a pardon is being reviewed by President Richard von Weizsäcker's office. Two German foreign ministry officials are currently in Geneva to discuss with UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar the German role in a possible swap of Western hostages for imprisoned Palestinians. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Iraq has called for the pullout of Turkish troops from northern Iraq and turned down the forming of a buffer zone along the common border. The official Iraqi news agency said the only way to ensure good relations between the two nations is non-intervention. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 7 points to close at 3,008.72 on volume of some 213 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR News. In Yugoslavia, government leaders met again to try and make a ceasefire stronger, but a Serbian military commander says that there will be more fighting. This latest ceasefire went into effect last week in an effort to stop the fighting between Serbian and Croatian forces. Last night, though, was the quietest in weeks in Croatia, but federal efforts to send ceasefire observers into the breakaway republic have been blocked. Officials in France say that they believe two men wanted in connection with the murder of former Iranian Prime Minister Shahpour Bakhtiar were detained briefly by French and Swiss police after the killing was discovered. The two men, both Iranians, were stopped as they tried to leave France. Andrew Bell filed this report for the BBC.
A spokesman at the Ministry of the Interior said this morning that two men answering the description of the suspects Ali Vakili Rad and Mohammed Azadi tried to enter Switzerland last Wednesday. They were travelling on Turkish passports that bore assumed names and were turned back at the border when Swiss police discovered that their visas were forged. French police then checked their documents but found their papers for France were in order. A computer check was also run on the two men, but they were not found to be on any list of wanted persons. They were then let go. At this stage, the bodies of Dr. Bakhtiar and his secretary, who'd been murdered in a Paris suburb on Tuesday night, had still not been discovered. The police now consider it likely that the two men are still in France, and having been refused entry into Switzerland, may now be trying to cross into Italy or Spain.
Andrew Bell in Paris. Retail sales were up in July, rising 0.5%. The government also says that sales were up in June instead of down as first reported. Because of this, the Commerce Department says that for the first time in a year, there was a three-month string of advances. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Bruce Wagner is a Hollywood screenwriter who's written a novel about a Hollywood screenwriter's attempts to get a movie made from one of his scripts. Force Majeure is a dark comic look at the inside workings of Hollywood deal-making. The protagonist, Bud Wiggins, exists on the margins of Hollywood with desperate fantasies of making it. The story caught the eye of Oliver Stone, who wants to produce the movie, with Wagner as director. Wagner is no outsider to Hollywood. He grew up there, dropped out of Beverly Hills High School, and has had some success as a screenwriter. He co-wrote the screenplays for Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills and Nightmare on Elm Street, Part 3. Force Majeure also refers to a clause in a film contract.
Force Majeure is an act of God clause, and I believe it's also in it's not just the writer's contract, it's in actresses and actor and director. What it really means that in case of a catastrophe, natural or unnatural, you know, man-made or not, nuclear war, fire, strike, walkout, the list is endless, that the studio doesn't have to honor their contracts with the artist or the writer in this case. So I excerpted that clause from the contract in the beginning of my book to show just how the odds were stacked against this character before the book even began.
Well, it does raise a question about what an act of God means in Hollywood.
Yeah, usually it means a green light. You know, someone says, yes, you can make this movie. But yeah, I put it in there because it's alarming when you actually, you know, most of us don't pay too much attention to our contracts. They're handled either by lawyers or your agent who's familiar enough with them to tell you whether you're being, you know, mishandled or not.
Well, it reminds
a euphemism, but if you actually pause to look at the force majeure clause, it's a terrifying moment, you know, to see just exactly what they can invoke if they want not to pay you.
It reminds me of what's told to patients before surgery about all the things that can go wrong in surgery, all the multiple ways that you can die under the knife.
Yeah, right. So if you're smart at that point, you get up off the table and run, you know. But most of us submit to the scalpel anyway, you know. I'm one of those who's addicted to surgery, I guess.
The character of your novel, Bud Wiggins, at least in the beginning of the book, seems to intend not to write for movies, wants to make, as you say, an assault on literature. I assume that that's having a larger goal than just writing for movies. Did you have that as well?
Well, not really. I mean, I was always, I loved books, and but I don't think, I don't think I ever seriously, I always considered myself a writer, but not until my mid-20s did I start to write, and that was for the movies. I think I might have written some little O. Henry parodies or something, you know, when I was a kid, but beyond that, no. So I began writing for the movies, and that seemed quite natural to me, and I don't know, something just clicked in my 30s where I thought I should write some prose. I think I got, you get tired of the murkiness of writing screenplays. Nothing is permanent, you know. What you're writing is, it's another cliche, but it is a blueprint, you know, and it's not fixed. It's missing that chemical that fixes it, that, you know, that, that when you're developing a picture that you mix in and it fixes the image, it's constantly fluid and changing and changeable and subject to other people's revisions, and you don't own it. It's not yours. I don't mean literally, but you don't possess it. Someone else can work on it. So I think that was exhausting for me. And at the same time, I thought that there was a muscle, a prose writing muscle that I could use or develop that I hadn't, that was there, but you know, was flaccid because of the years of writing the three acts of movies. You know what I mean?
If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Bruce Wagner. He's a screenwriter and now a novelist. His book is called Force Majeure. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Bruce Wagner is my guest. In the novel, Force Majeure, the Bud Wiggins character is this struggling, aspiring screenwriter, and you begin to get the feeling that everyone is kind of colluding with him, and this is a guy that kind of has brainstorms at every turn, and yet we watch him kind of descend into this kind of abyss in a way. What I like so much about it is this kind of Hollywood reality that you create, and the ideas are let's do a Home Alone type movie, or let's do something that has a Field of Dreams elements to it. Is right. that how people talk? Is that
oh, yeah,
how producers
endlessly.
Talk?
Endlessly. It's weird. The town is very dreamlike because, you know, you can really believe anything that you want to believe. I mean, let's say that. I mean, I remember a long time ago I was working on a script at Paramount that was about a vacation gone bad, and at the same time, John Hughes was working on the first National Lampoon's Vacation. You know, so. But he was quite far ahead of us. And once it was found out that he was working on it, well, you could either throw your hands up and say, oh, no, and abandon the project, or you could say, well, this is good because a trend has been identified and you're right there at the leading edge of this trend. I mean, just like someone, you know, who could be developing Home Alone, you know, the minute Home Alone came out and made $200 million, well, you know, Hollywood, the mentality is like, that's great. There's someone doing what we're doing and they've made hundreds of millions of dollars. It's not that, oh, we can't do this because they've already done it. You know what I mean? So the town constantly feeds on itself, endlessly cannibalizes itself.
And thinks trend. I mean, trend is the kind of catchword, byword.
Well, I don't know so much trend as because you never, you know, that part of, I think, the weird sort of almost killer thrill of the town is you never know, no one ever knows what's going to come out of the blue and make a ton of money. And so it's almost as if the town is some kind of weird metropolis that's cruised by producers and studio executives waiting for that, like Boys in the Hood. You know what I mean? They, you just never know. I mean, when Boys in the Hood, there's a big billboard on Sunset Boulevard that says, you know, I've forgotten the name of the man who made Boys in the Hood.
Singleton.
What's his, John?
John Singleton.
Yeah, it says John Singleton. This is right there on Sunset Boulevard across from the Hyatt House. John Singleton had a vision. Columbia Pictures, let him express it. Something like that. It was a self-congratulatory, you know, very sort of regal, announcement, a way of publicizing this movie. So, you know, when something makes money, it's the thrill, the kind of ecstatic, you know, collective thrill on the backs of everyone really in the business. You know, this is what people gear up for. They gear up for that something out of the blue, that, you know, that something that drops dollars down from heaven, you know. And it doesn't matter what movie it is. And the fact that it's unpredictable makes people, I think that it excites people. It makes them think that they're in a business that's volatile and they're not wasting their lives because something can come along and clobber them with money or even clobber them with invisibility, you know, tragedy. You know, that they can spend 2 years toiling on something that has absolutely no impact on anyone and that barely comes out. You know what I mean? That goes straight to video.
I'd like you to read a section from your book where Bud Wiggins is in a screenwriter's meeting. Perhaps you can set it up for us.
This is where he takes he's been out of work for a long time, and he gets a call out of the blue that they want him to take a meeting over at Universal where they've read an old script of his that they're very interested in. And he comes to the meeting, and he's stunned because there's like 12 people in the meeting. One of them is a very recognizable star who is named Billy Quintero, a guy who's known for his sort of protean characterizations of and his mania for research. And he starts to give them his comments. It's a script. They've sent him a dummy script that's just something they dug out of the warehouse, but they've convinced him that it's a hot script that's about to go into production. They want him to perhaps revise it. So he's got to give them his notes. Have you read the script? Levitt asked. Bud had some problems with it, Feld interjected. That's why we're here, said the producer. The screenwriter took a breath. It was time. The body exchange stuff has been done to death, he said soberly. He was careful not to be cocky. No matter how bad the script was, there was invariably a minefield of hidden agendas. For all he knew, it might have been the idea of Joel Levitt's dying 7-year-old daughter. Or maybe Quintero came up with it. Why else would he be here? The material didn't warrant his presence, if only because the two leads were barely out of their teens. Quintero was almost 40. He hadn't done a film in 2 years. He was choosy, picked his shots well. The studio could never force him into a room like this. He had to be seriously interested. Joel Levitt aside, Bud had read somewhere that the star wanted to do comedy. But Quintero was too old for this project, and Bud knew he had to address that. It was a test. I'm not so sure they should be teenagers. Go on, said Levitt. You're getting warm. Can we back up, Bud said, buying time. He was starting to blank. Bud has some general notes, the agent offered. As I said, we've seen the body exchange stuff before. No one could argue with that. He decided to play it out. That was one of Billy's concerns, said the producer. Bingo. Still, it's been a while since Big, Bud said. If it's handled right, that's something an audience always loves. So I'd combine it with the subplot about the guy who gets made into the Pope. Combine it, Levitt echoed flatly. Right. Bud tried to gauge the room. They were still listening. The way it is now, he said, the guy is made Pope by mistake. That just couldn't happen. I mean, when they pick the Dalai Lama, maybe. But the Pope, it's a process with the cardinals and the puffs of smoke. Levitt straightened up like he'd slapped himself with aftershave. So you'd have the guy from Newark wake up inside the Pope's body? Bud nodded, an old safecracker passing on his secrets. It's cleaner. Also, Jeremiah's too passive, which I don't particularly mind. It's just that I think there's a Field of Dreams element that needs to be drawn out.
Does that pretty much mirror some of the meetings that you've been to?
Well, I mean, they do meetings, you know, like that a lot of the time because people suddenly, you know, it's weird. It's like there's all these moments during meetings where people's sort of their minds drop out of the meeting because no one really has, no one can concentrate in, you know, I don't think anywhere. So in a meeting, you have the minds drop out and what happens is, just to say something, someone will reference something that they've seen recently on cable or HBO or, you know, something they saw at the movies in the past few nights. No matter what it is, if it worked, they will bring it in and they will reference it and they will demand that you acknowledge, you know, they're bringing it to the table. It's very weird.
I'm wondering, too, whether people corner you and say, is that me or is that so-and-so? People that imagine seeing themselves or other people in your fiction.
Yeah, I've had some of that, not a lot. And it's weird. Man, it is really out there. I'm telling you, it's some of it is, well, you know, a relative of mine read it and asked me if someone was so-and-so, and this person that they thought I was portraying is someone that, you know, is from a different generation that really no longer works in the business, someone they knew, but someone I don't. So the book, you know, the book is not a Romana Clay. It's because that's tiresome also to me. I don't, you know, I leave that, you know, to the people that are writing books called, you know, The Studio or the Malibu Colony. You know, I don't have any, to me it's like, it shows that you know, I would be somewhat impoverished if, you know, to make a book that's all full of people that we already know, you know. But it's inevitable in Hollywood, you know. So in other words, if you show my book to someone, and you know, if my book is still around and if anyone's around in 50 years, and Hollywood is, I'm sure, probably will be thriving, then there would be a whole new set of people that would, you know, just fill in the blanks. You know, these archetypes exist, and the permutations of them. And, you know, people will come along every 5 years and be the, you know, the one that fulfills that archetype. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Thank you very much, Bruce Wagner.
Thank you.
Bruce Wagner is a screenwriter and a first-time novelist. His book is called Force Majeure. He hopes to direct the movie version of the novel. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us what they're covering today on the show. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. Today we'll be hearing more about the talks and negotiations going on in efforts to release hostages in the Middle East, and who exactly UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar is talking to, representing Hezbollah, which seems to be holding most of the people. We'll also hear a report from NPR's Richard Harris about a project in Greenland to dig deep beneath the ice, and by so doing to study climatic changes that took place years and years and years ago, and to study what might be the effects of future climatic changes and how we might avoid any climatic catastrophes that we might bring on ourselves at this point.
Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Religion and sin have often been bedfellows in literature. There's a new mystery novel that hooks on the tension between the two by D. Keith Mano called Topless. John Leonard has a review.
Topless is a nifty little thriller, full of mayhem, wisecracks, inside info, and a surprising amount of God. Someone is killing the bare-breasted dancers in a topless bar in Queens, New York, called The Smoking Car. We get to know these dancers before their bodies are discovered, stabbed, shot, or decapitated, hanging from a trapeze or stuffed in the trunk of an abandoned car. We also get to know their creepy clientele, and the bouncers, and the drug dealers, and the mafiosi who haunt their nights like moons and strobes. The gimmick here is that our detective is a young Episcopal priest, Father Mike Wilson, who is summoned back from his parish in Nebraska to take over the topless bar when its owner, Mike's older brother Tony, disappears. Mike has his problems with sex, and his problems with the Episcopal Church, and can't seem to finish the Thomas Merton novel he's reading, and doesn't know what to do with the cocaine he's always finding in his pockets. But the cops suspect him of the murders, and the tabloid newspapers have a field day. And even though some members of his own church think his walk on the wild side is a sort of liberation theology, he knows he isn't getting any closer to his God. He continues to pray, he tells us, almost out of spite. Meanwhile, he's also detecting, like the Hound of Heaven. With the help of a beer-drinking cat, he'll catch the killer before the killer catches him. It's as if Graham Greene, on a feckless day, had decided to take a stroll through Tom Wolfe's vanities and met an American psycho, except the women are much more likable. But Topless is another story, too, a cautionary tale about the culture. It's been 10 years between novels for D. Keith Mano. He used to turn them out faster than anybody could read them, 8 of them in a little more than a decade. Quirky and ambitious books like Bishop's Progress, Horn, and The Proselytizer, about religion and science and war and race relations. Mano is a serious Christian and a political right-winger, and these novels troubled his secular humanist reviewers. But the reviews were at least respectful until Take Five in 1981. Take Five was about a pornographic movie maker who lost each of his senses, one by one, on his way either to a state of grace or the extinguishing void. In almost 600 pages, numbered backwards from 581 to zero, it spoke in many tongues, and all of them were offensive to every imaginable color and creed and ethnic persuasion, as if the novel were a garbage disposal into which the novelist fed every piety of the liberal culture, the psychobabble of the bleeding hearts. I'm a bleeding heart secular humanist myself, but I've been dazzled by right-wing writers from Joseph de Maistre to Ezra Pound to Evelyn Waugh, and I liked Take Five a lot. Nobody else did, not even Mano's publisher. It was a publishing disaster. There followed a long silence, during which Mano wrote for television, including a couple of episodes of St. Elsewhere, and for Bill Buckley's National Review magazine. Last year, for a lot of money, he sold the idea for Topless to a movie studio, the high concept of an Episcopal priest in a topless bar, and then wrote the book, which has already gotten more space and better reviews than Take Five. Take Five was a scary masterwork. Topless is a slick entertainment. Since he couldn't beat the culture, Mano joined it. I don't blame him, but I missed the brilliant pariah.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Topless by D. Keith Mano. The interviews and reviews you hear on Fresh Air are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with help from Susan Weinstein and Joan Tui. Fresh Air is directed today by Roberta Sharrock. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, we look at how Supreme Court nominees have been chosen throughout history with law professor Walter Dellinger. He advised the Senate Judiciary Committee on recent Supreme Court nominations, including that of Robert Bork. That and more coming up on the next Fresh Air.